Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on the show, some very serious matters as we try to understand our food and farm bill, although we know the farm bill was recently re-signed, shall I say, just, you know, a couple of months ago. But the conversation still continues with lots of folks who are interested in seeing some sort of reform. And one of the ways in which I think people like us, or people like me at least, I can really only speak for myself.
Us is good.
Okay. You know, try to understand it a little bit better. Dan Imhoff has written a book. It's called Food Fight, A Citizen's Guide to a Food and Farm Bill, where, you know, just sort of explains in very clear language the loopholes that exist that are sort of messing up our food systems.
Beyond that, my mind.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. It is so complicated, and he lays out the ripple effect in a very broad way.
Lobby groups have run this country for the last 10 or 15 years, or maybe longer.
Longer than that,
And the lobby, the farm lobby, is one of them. And this is a man leading a very, very, very uphill fight to get the country back in the right track. I'm philosophically with him, and I'm morally and spiritually with him. It's just such a long fight, and I'm glad he's fighting it.
Right, and like the book, this particular book was published before the debate for the last farm bill. So it's it's been around. So we have another 5 years to take a harder look at it as well, try to get more people interested. So the information is before us, Bob. So now we need to run with it, right?
Yep.
So Dan's going to help us sort of sort through some of that. So we hope that you'll stick with us. And one of our favorite local gardeners,
Mad Michael Heyman, who kind of got me in this business in a lot of ways. And Mike, in his own way, is a man who's leading a fight to get a lot done in Seneca Gardens, which he's created just an incredible arboretum what's a subdivision, really. And at Whitehall, it's a local historic home where Mike has spent 10, 12 years taking a place that had totally gone to wreck and ruin and converting it into a really beautiful place to visit. It's a show place, and he works thousands of hours to make it that way, and he's donated all his time and a lot of money and gasoline to make it happen. And it's worth seeing, and a lot of people in Louisville don't even know it's there.
Well, and it's also such a fabulous teaching tool because there's so many interesting plants there, and it's so well done that, you know, when people ask us, they want to learn more about stuff, and that's a place to go.
And Mike's very generous with his time out there, as is Ralph Archer, the fern guy.
But they have a gardener out there as well.
Yeah, Annie. Uh-huh. And they all love to have company and explain what they're doing.
That's right. So we'll hear from Mike here in just a little bit. In the meantime, Bob, what's going on in your garden?
It's cut your losses time, kiddo.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Now, what I've been doing, you know, that recent drought we had in August, and a lot of plants didn't make it, didn't flower up to what I hoped. And so I just cut them back before they just look bad.
Yeah.
Sometimes you wait till fall or early spring and cut them back. I said, nope. Mm-hmm. You've tried real hard, buddy, but we're going to cut you back. And didn't kill them.
Right.
But I just got tired of looking at these brownish leaves and flowers.
Said the and heck all with herbaceous stuff, not woody stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, uh-huh. My herbaceous stuff. So, you know, sometimes part of gardening is just cutting your losses, giving your plants a break, cut them back to the ground and water them and wait for next year.
Yeah.
Find out what doesn't work.
And let the plants sort of tell you when they're ready to be herbaceous plants, when they're ready to be cut back, because some stuff does just look dreadful by now.
Yeah, and even the stuff that
plants finished using it.
Yeah, I've had stuff that was supposed to bloom and didn't. Uh-huh. I cut that back too. The other thing is, I made a vow, another one of my 27 vows a week I make, to plant more sedums and lantanas next year, because they're both
they're tough in the summer.
Yeah, and they look good. Uh-huh. They're drought tolerant, and my zinnias have been fabulous for interspersed with color annual zinnias, big tall ones. So more sedums, lantanas, and cut my losses.
All right.
But I wish you stayed. What's up?
I have a groundhog story for you. Uh-oh. I think, you know how I'm having green bean failure this year?
This isn't a shadow story, is it?
I think it's the groundhog that's been eating my green beans.
What's the hole look like?
It's just a big humongous hole in the barn. Okay, so the story is this.
Okay.
We have this old fishing boat. You know, there's more to the story than just the story with me.
Always.
There's an old rowboat in the barn.
Of course.
It's been there
Everybody has those.
Of course. So Andy got the old rowboat out because we like to sort of tootle around on our little lake.
I didn't hear the word leaky.
And no, it's perfectly fine.
Okay.
We call it the SS Walker because Dr. Jim Walker gave it to my dad and we moved out there. So
good.
Dr. Walker, it's his old fishing boat. So we got the boat out, cleaned it up, and we tootle around in the rowboat. So underneath the rowboat, there was this big hole that had been dug, and it had been there for quite a long time, in fact.
No dummy.
So when Andy had moved all the stuff out to get the boat out, we, of course, clean up when before you put everything back, right?
Right.
So we filled the dirt back into the hole. So then the next morning, I go back to the barn to let the chickens out, and Buck has something cornered back in that corner, and I hear this noise. It's like...
Yeah, an angry...
And like teeth chomping together, you know, and I'm like, what is that? So I go over there, and Buck's there with the groundhog.
Uh-oh.
And I'm like, oops, I bet the groundhog came back and found that its hole was filled. So he was a little pissed off, right? So we had to go somewhere. So we're like, okay, gotta go. So then get home that evening, and the hole has been redug already. But that quick.
Yeah, that's what groundhogs do.
But then again, the hole was just filled with loose dirt that, you know, so it wasn't all compacted.
But did you put
the
boat back?
No, the boat's still out down by the lake.
Uh-oh.
And, you know, I have no problem with it being there. I'm pretty sure it's been there forever. Not forever, but, you know, for a while, a long time. He doesn't eat chickens. He may eat some of my green beans, but I can always protect those next year.
Well, so do I.
So, you know, because somebody said it. You know what the answer to that is, 22 to the... And I'm like, no, I don't need to do that. He's not doing anything. And he's not necessarily aggressive. I never see him except when I fill his hole up.
Well, can Buck become groundhog friendly, friendly at some point?
Buck, I kind of warned Buck. I'm like, honey, you need to back off because this thing could tear you up. Because Buck's not real good at the whole attack wildlife thing.
I've heard the same from my wife. It didn't work.
Yeah, so we'll see. But they've been coexisting fine before.
That's cool.
As long as a groundhog can go in its hole, I think it's probably better.
And your groundhog's name is?
Good question.
We'll have one next week.
Okay.
I'll name your groundhog for you.
Okay.
We'll have a groundhog quiz.
Let's do.
Next week.
You're on, mister.
I'll have a groundhog quiz.
Three names to vote on.
And then I'll give you a groundhog, five or six questions. Things you didn't know about groundhogs.
Okay. Am I allowed to do research? Preliminary research?
None.
I got to come into it cold. Okay.
Yep.
All right. You're on. Okay.
I'll be here.
All right. So moving right along. You're on. So is Mike Heyman. Mike gets a little credit for, I think, molding the little bit of your horticultural philosophy. Kind of the Bob that we know today. Mike had a little bit of a hand.
He takes much of the blame for that, I must admit. Yeah. Mike's been the tree and shrub czar of Seneca Gardens for many years, where his knowledge, expertise, and hands-on enthusiasm has enabled him to create one of the nation's most interesting and exotic suburban landscapes. He shared that enthusiasm with garden clubs and organizations across Louisville and southern Indiana, as well as Bernheim Arboretum and Udell in Oldham County. In the past 10 or 15 years, he's donated thousands of hours to restore and improve the grounds of Whitehall, one of Louisville's famed historic homes. Mike, welcome to Homegrown.
Thanks for asking me.
Yeah, for the people who've driven along Lexington Road for many years and never pulled in there, and they sure should have over these many years, kind of catch us up on what's a Whitehall and its grounds. What would they find in there?
Well, Whitehall is 10 acres with a mansion that was built about the 1850s across from the Ursuline campus. We've got three gardens there. We've got an entrance garden that the master gardeners of Jefferson County take care of and maintain. And then to the right of the house is a fern woodland garden that Ralph Archer has put in. He's got approximately 150 varieties of ferns and a lot of woodland plants. Then in the back, in the formal gardens, Annie Wendt, our part-time gardener, manages those. And then even farther in the back, she has a serpentine garden, which is another form of an herbaceous garden.
Mm-hmm. So the gardens there, relatively new, really, to the...
They all are new, yes.
To the site, to Whitehall. Is there a method to the madness in terms of trying to restore the property in the garden sense in a way that it had been at one point, or is this something that took on a new direction once people, you know, realized the potential?
Well, the first effort was in the formal gardens because they were already there.
Uh-huh.
And they were also closest to the mansion. So for our events, it's most important that they look good.
Sure.
So that was the beginning part. And then I always did want to, because we had woodland on both sides of the property, always hope that we could do a woodland garden.
Makes sense.
And when Ralph Archer became interested, he's our regional fern expert, well, we went with it because it was just a natural fit. We had shade, ferns grow in shade, and he was an expert. So.
And it's a showcase. I mean, honestly, if that's an interest of anyone's, that is the garden to see for the Woodland Fern showcase.
It's probably the most unique garden at Whitehall because there's so many varieties there. Mm-hmm. And we claim we're the best fern garden between Birmingham and Chicago.
I think so.
And then at the entrance, the master gardeners of Jefferson County became interested in a project a few years ago, and we walked the grounds, offered them various sites, and they chose the old entrance columns. So they have installed a garden there that looks, you know, really has dressed up the entrance.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's have some details on the Woodland Garden and maybe Ralph's Fern Garden. Tell us what's in there and how it got there.
Well, when Ralph became interested, as he moved out of his home in Middletown, downsized, he was looking for a site. I think this was accidental that we were available.
Or serendipitous, perhaps.
It was serendipitous. Yeah. He had 2 acres in Middletown, and a lot of those plants then were transplanted into Whitehall.
All right.
He's got, I would guess, 150 varieties of ferns, but we've also got a number of woodland plants that are companion plants. And just recently, we put in a small fern wall. Ralph wanted to have a wall that he had ferns growing out of, and we've just installed one of those, and it wasn't a week later, and Ralph had it completely planted. So
yeah, right.
I didn't know where all these ferns came from.
So when you say a wall, you mean like a rock wall sort of thing?
Okay. Yes. It's a stacked wall of big, blocky. It's not real big, but all the cracks, we intentionally left cracks in the sides and the tops, and they are... They've already got ferns in them.
And there are times during the year, and we'll have this on our website, when Ralph teaches out there, gives little courses, mini courses on ferns and what to do and how to do it and so forth.
Ralph is always willing to give tours to clubs or individuals.
And you're talking a couple hundred feet or more of woodland garden here.
I was trying to, I would guess we're approaching an acre of woodland garden in there by now. We have a major expansion going on this year. And the way we do it is we put, to keep the labor low and the chemicals away from the property, is we put cardboard down and then a foot of mulch. And that basically kills off the Euonymus coloratus, which is an invasive plant. And we just let it sit fallow for a year and then it gets planted. It's very simple. And everything that's put in decays and becomes a part of the soil. And we've got a major expansion this year, which would probably take a couple of years to fill in.
Sure. So, okay, the woodland garden, the fernery, lots of different ferns, but obviously there's other stuff in there too that's suitable for a woodland garden. What else?
Oh, there are lots of plants, but it's not my expertise.
Okay. We'll let you off the hook for that. Okay. Moving back towards the mansion and around the mansion, I know is your expertise because you've actually been a figure that has acquired, selected, and planted some of the trees and shrubs and other things. So let's talk about that, Mike.
Yeah, my ownership is the trees, the shrubs, the structure, the infrastructure. And we had probably only one nice tree on the property when I got there, and that's a giant sycamore in the woods, which is almost invisible. People don't know it's there unless you walk into the woods. But I started about 12, 13, 14 years ago, and some of those trees are starting to look nice. There's a really nice Texas cedar elm in the parking lot in the back. Big, quirky bark, deeply furled trunk. It's really a spectacular tree.
Texas cedar elm?
Yes. Latin is Ulmus crassifolia.
Okay, so it's an elm.
Yes, it is an elm.
It's got little saddles on it. You can't miss it.
It's a great tree. It looks a lot like our winged elm, except it's bigger. The wings are bigger, the tree is bigger, and the bark is more deeply furled.
And so real quirky looking.
Yes, okay. That's a really nice tree. That was out at Hidden Hill at one time, but I spirited it away.
For those of you who don't know, Hidden Hill almost kind of found its life as a nursery for Michael Heyman's crazy plants that he collected from all across the United States.
I'm only half joking. He would leave trees in the back of my car knowing I was too nice a guy to let them die. And I would take them
and
home
and
put them
out. And they lived their first few years out there until they found a home for them.
Let's talk around the house, Michael. You got some crab apples. You got a fabulous big head viburnum in the front yard. Talk about that.
Oh, the viburnum macrocephalum is spectacular. It has huge flowers. I hope I'm not exaggerating the size of a soccer ball, that size. That's a spectacular plant. It's been so successful. We actually had to reduce its size this year. It had been so big and so successful. But so that is one of the spectacular shrubs. The Viburnum dilatatums are really flashy this time of year. Some of the good trees, there's an excellent white tigress, striped bark maple. It must be 25 feet tall now. Smooth bark with bright white, green and white stripes in it. We have a couple of Theodore Klein selection of a witch's broom sugar maple called Shawnee, which is a very round. It looks like it's been pruned, but it's not. It just forms that perfect ball shaped. A young sycamore that's been put in the back called Sutnerai, which came from Bernheim Arboretum. Chalky white bark. We're going to repeat that in the fern garden because that is a very spectacular looking tree. Oh, there's a wonderful contorted beech to the left of the house, which is...
And so many of these plants are truly specialty plants, wouldn't you say?
They are.
So, Mike, when people do come to visit, is it unfair or mean? Because it's like, wow, look at all this fabulous stuff, but I don't know where you can find it. You know what I mean? So, like, what's your recommendation for people that are pretty hardcore and that they want what you've got?
I always try to help them find it. Okay. I remember, this goes back to my experience with Buddy Hubbock at Bernheim. Mm-hmm. At Bernheim Arboretum years ago, I would go through with him and plant after plant I loved. And I said, where can I buy it? He said, nowhere.
Yeah.
So
you remember that visceral feeling of
frustration.
That
is. And so when I find something unusual, I try to get it to propagators. We have... As you both know, we have connections all over the country. Sometimes we'll send things to Oregon, sometimes for propagators. Sometimes we have a couple of local propagators. There's one in Tennessee at a Hidden Hollow Nursery, a friend of both Bob and mine. And among all these people, we usually can find a way to get things propagated. Now, you can't always get it the size you want it or as fast as you want it, but if people are patient, we can get all of these things. Mm-hmm.
And then to kind of continue the path, the transition from the fern garden to the more formal garden is this wonderful oak leaf hydrangea path that must be stunning right now.
It is great. And that was a direct imitation of a description I heard of the Nash Garden, where I heard they had 8 feet tall oak leaf hydrangeas that you could walk between. Mm-hmm. So we put about 25 or 30
right.
of them.
Yeah.
And they are now 8 feet tall, and you enter the fern garden through an 8-foot...
Oak leaf hydrangea, LA sort of thing.
It is. And Bob, actually, I don't know if you remember this, you helped do that when you took out those mulberries.
I'm still waiting to get paid.
Yeah.
And then going on from there, you have the more formal garden, the old Whitehall garden. Describe that and what's been done to renovate that.
Yeah, the bones of that were there when I got involved 12, 13, 14 years ago. But what we've done, and what we've done just recently, is we have installed some hardscape that connects all of these rooms. It was always divided up into rooms, but these rooms were not connected. So we have added one small terrace in the back that's about 20 by 60 feet this winter, and we've widened all the paths, and now all of these rooms are connected, and our clients have found inventive ways to use it, so I know that that's been successful.
Mm-hmm.
That was
in terms of people that have parties and receptions
and
weddings
so
and such
rentals.
Out there. When you say your clients, yeah.
right, mm-hmm. the rentals, mm-hmm. And that's really exciting to see. It's now modular, and they can go this way or they can go that way, and they're inventing new ways. So
it's sort of European in a lot of ways. Now you go back in there and kind of get lost. Then there's the row of peonies along the edge. You have your peony festival every year. Talk about that.
We have approximately 50 varieties every spring. We bring in new ones and take a couple out every year, so there's some rotation. And it's spectacular. It's about the middle of May every year that we have a peony fest, which is free.
And then Annie's garden in the back there. Describe. I know you're not a perennial guy, but try and describe what some of those leafy things are, well, yeah, what's back there. Because it's really a fabulous garden. It looks good every year, every time of the year. Really.
Yeah, it's very serpentine. There are no straight lines. One thing that's kind of interesting, Annie's been willing to plant some of these woodies, these small woodies. So some of these dwarf and unusual shaped woodies, we will grow there. Instead of growing them in a nursery, put them there.
A true
and
mixed border, huh?
It is mixed, right. Mm-hmm. And we'll have things like a weeping mimosa in there. We have right now, for the short term anyway, a Pinus palustris, or a longleaf pine, which probably draws the most questions of anything. It's got these huge needles on it. Eventually, it's going to outgrow the site.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a contorted hairy Lauder's walking stick with purple foliage. a lot of items like that, some dwarf ginkgos. Mm-hmm. So those are mixed in with the herbaceous.
Yeah, the grasses, and she's good use of some annuals even. She uses in there a little bit, I think. And
yeah.
Just the whole thing front to back is how long? What, maybe a half mile? Is that an exaggeration?
Well, it's 10 acres, and it's roughly a rectangle, a narrow rectangle. If you were comparing it to a football field, it looks like it'd be a couple of football fields in length.
Okay, and I know you cringe at the thought of this, but the public can come in there and walk around and look at your precious plants.
I don't cringe.
Okay. But anybody can go in there any time of the day and walk around and look at it, right?
Well, we have events sometimes that rent it on weekends, but otherwise it's open to the public. And our hours are basically when it's daylight.
We come at midnight, right?
No. We will eventually establish some hours when it's officially open, but essentially right now it's when it's daylight.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah. Thanks, Mike.
Mike, thanks a lot, man.
You're welcome.
For everything.
Thanks.
Mike Haman has spent a lifetime, or it seems like it, trying to restore the historic home of Whitehall off Lexington Road. For more information on Mike or Whitehall, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, Dan Imhoff and Food Fight. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Bob Hill here. Welcome back to Homegrown.
And Janine Wishy, indeed, welcome back. And, you know, I think listeners know over the years that the whole farm thing is pretty close to my heart. I know they farm and we eat.
Well,
but
I
don't think everybody realizes that.
Well, my
so
family's farmers. My wife's family's farmers. Uh-huh. I worked in farms as a kid. And invariably, the first 30 seconds back when a new Congress comes together, they pass a farm bill. Uh-huh. That nobody understands, but it's always a payback for the farmers and the agribusiness people and the lobbyists and so forth. And they're very complex.
The average person doesn't understand it at all, or care about it, I guess.
Well, they care, and it's here and gone.
Yeah.
But it is beyond. The consumers don't care, and most of the farmers do. So.
Right. So along that lines, other folks that do care and really trying to sort of educate the public include Dan Imhoff, and he is the author and publisher of a book called Food Fight, The Citizen's Guide to a Food and Farm Bill, which addresses how subsidized agriculture in America may be doing more harm than good, really,
right,
economically, environmentally, and otherwise. Nutritionally, we can look at that, you know, kids' school lunches, etc. The book explains the ripple effect of the farm bill and recommends also, Bob, how we can influence change for the next time that the farm bill comes up, which is still several years off. So Dan's going to help us sort of sort through it a little bit. Dan, welcome to Homegrown and thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Sure. In terms of the farm bill, what was the purpose of the very first farm bill?
You know, to understand the farm bill, you have to go back to the days of the Great Depression in the early 1930s when we had really, you know, multiple challenges before us. One was agricultural, you know, years of overplowing land that probably should never have been plowed, complicated with a severe drought, and then followed by really wet weather just caused erosion problems and what we know as the Dust Bowl. And you can just imagine the very foundation of agriculture, the soil, literally blowing away.
Yeah.
And then also, I think the 1930s were the real end of the agrarian experiment in the United States. And we saw this massive migration from the land toward cities.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, we had a global economic crisis, and millions, tens of millions of Americans who were underemployed and unemployed and hungry. And, you know, in came Franklin Roosevelt in the very early days of his administration with his Secretary of Agriculture, Henry Wallace, and they decided that there had to be some means to rescue this food and farming system from what it had become, and that government was going to have to play a role and could play a significant role. It was definitely very unconventional at the time, and not everybody believed in it. And Roosevelt said himself that, you know, this farm bill was a means to rescue agriculture, and that if it didn't work, then he would adjust. And unfortunately, you know, with many, many entitlement programs and bureaucracies that get set in place once they're created and the genie's let out of the bottle, so to speak, it's very hard to get that genie back in the bottle.
Mm-hmm.
But those early days were really geared toward helping farmers in a very complex way take care of their land and get fair prices for their crops, and then also to find ways to distribute food to the needy. It really had very two distinct elements,
mm-hmm.
a feeding program and a farmer assistance program.
And to put that in perspective a little bit, this was geared toward the little farmer, right? There was no agribusiness industry then. This was to help farmers.
Well, you know, I think that the agribusiness industry as we know it today, if you really follow some leads, you'll find that agribusiness and big, powerful trusts in agriculture have been building since even the late 19th century, especially the agrochemical companies that we know today and the, you know, even the big life science genetic engineering companies that we have today have their roots back in big chemical industries in the late 1800s. But we were a nation of 6 million family farmers at the time,
mm-hmm.
and compared to today, we're way below 2 million. We're way below 1% of the American population.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the big needs that farmers had at the time was loans and credit. And a lot of these early programs, they weren't direct payments and giveaways like we know today. They were loan-based, and there weren't just, you know, a handful of commodities that were getting the payments. There were hundreds of crops. And the idea was to try to make a safety net, to set a fair price for these people, and to give them money to get crops in the ground. At the same time, there were some social obligations that anyone who participated in the programs had to abide by. And one was you had to set aside 25% of your arable ground, in many cases, in order to protect the soil, but also to keep overproduction, you know, to keep prices reasonable, you know, from all the way from, I think, time immemorial, but especially in the 20th century, what we found was that, you know, farmers, the only mechanism that they had to get ahead was to plant as much as possible. But the more they planted, the greater the supply, the lower the price,
mm-hmm.
and they could never really get ahead unless their compatriots somewhere else were suffering losses. And so, you know, these early programs, they were loan-based, they were safety net based, and there was also some efforts at supply management so that there wasn't too much of any particular crop.
So the original form seems reasonable enough, right? So how did it become the farm bill and the subsidies that we know today?
Well, you know, every 5 years it got renegotiated, and I think, you know, over time, we had a farm policy and a food policy that was get big or get out oriented.
Mm-hmm.
And corporations and big agribusiness lobbies ultimately began to dominate the farm bill negotiations and even the writing of the bills and the slicing up of the pie. And, you know, every 5 years it seemed that agribusiness got bigger, there were fewer family farms, and we went from a safety net program that was really, you know, community oriented and conservation oriented and family farm oriented toward the maximization of industrial food.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what we have today. We have a program that originated in the 20th century and it's still highly rooted in the 20th century. And the problem is we're now in the 21st century, and our challenges are completely are a lot different.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, the Farm Bill is still this really essential tool. It's just not serving the American people the way it should, and we deserve a lot better.
So, Dan, can you give us a snapshot of how it is serving agribusiness, big agribusiness, and not serving the American people very well as it currently stands? Kind of some examples.
Yeah, well, a lot of it is just who gets the most money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 10% of the farmers get 80% of the payments that go toward agriculture incentives, and those are the biggest farmers. Oftentimes, they're corporations that are really hard to untangle, and it's impossible to justify them as family operations, and the system just lends itself toward the biggest operators because it's easier to just write a big check than a whole bunch of small checks.
And how does that impact the way that, the prices of food and the real prices that people actually get for some of these commodities that are the few that are subsidized the most, as opposed to the way that it used to be where, you know, there was a encouragement for all crops. And I think some people don't understand that really there's only a few crops that are subsidized in that mega dose sort of way. You know, what's the ripple effect of that, I guess, is the question.
Right. And let's just step back for mm-hmm. a second back to an older American farm and feeding structure where farms were smaller. They were a lot more diverse. They didn't just grow, 2,000 acres of corn and soybeans that go mostly into feedlots and processed food, et cetera. They had, mixed row crops and program crops, and they had pasture, they had animals, they had food that they sold locally, where, today much of our farm policy is just geared toward output, maximum output and specialization. And so what you have is, huge areas of the country where, sure, they're producing a lot of commodities, but they're not producing a lot of healthy food. They're growing a lot of corn and soybeans every year. You know, the yields get higher and higher, but, they're not growing any food that goes into the local supermarkets, and they're buying inputs that come from really far away. And they're growing crops that directly go out of the community. The money that they do spend on food goes out of the community and goes towards regions of the country and even increasingly other countries for the fresh fruits and vegetables and the healthy foods that mm-hmm. the USDA recommends. And why? Well, because these subsidies, they support a very narrow range of crops: corn, cotton, wheat, rice, soybeans, dairy, and sugar. Those are the main recipients of our Farm Bill programs. Now, it's true, this year, in this last 2008 Farm Bill, they've started to support what are called specialty crops, and that's a Farm Bill euphemism for crops that we actually eat, fresh fruits, and vegetables, and nuts.
Uh-huh.
And that's because, we have growers in California and Florida and the Northwest, other areas of the country that, for decades they've been reluctant to get into the Farm Bill discussions because they want to have their economic freedom. But ultimately they decided, this is too big of a game that's setting the rules for agriculture. We can no longer afford to be left out of the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Dad, I'm a complete and total cynic on all these lobbies, medical, banking, insurance, farm lobbies. I think they run the country and they're ruining the country. Having said that, as devil's advocate, don't you think that these massive farms do produce more food at lower prices than a network of family farms could have ever done?
No, I don't think that's true. I agree with your cynicism, and I think, unless we really tackle the big elephants in the living room, which is lobbying
exactly.
and money that goes in to influence the system, and the total and complete lack of enforcement of existing laws that allows big monopolies to get built, that allows huge corporations to pollute and degrade the environment, we're not going to get anywhere. But I think that when you look at the research, just the independent research, you'll find that small, diverse farms are far more productive than these massive monoculture operations that produce impressive amounts of a commodity, but really by tonnage and even calories, they're not nearly as efficient as a small farm can be. The other question is, well, what are we actually producing on these farms? We're producing feed for large and ever larger mega confinement animal operations. and processed foods that become the very cheapest foods in our supermarkets, and you know, especially prey on the poor who have to spend their money wisely, and they can make the cheapest things they can buy are the processed foods that are really high in fats and calories and additives and low in nutrition and fuel for our cars.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, the real challenge is, how do we make this all healthy? You know, how do we have farms that create healthy foods that are consumed regionally and locally that make us a healthful nation, soil-wise, water-wise, and nutritionally?
Well, so how do you go back 50 years and get 6 million family farms again?
That's a really good question. You know, and it's a fair question. Who's mm-hmm. going to do the work?
Right.
I don't necessarily have the answer to that, except that, you know, new data suggests that there are more people who want to get into farming than ever. There are more farms than there were 10 years ago, and they're small farms. The challenge is that the monies are so small and the needs are so great, and that's why I find the Farm Bill is a real lightning rod for change, and why we should look at it as an intervention point, a place where we can focus on. We might not get it. We might have to, you know, be a lot more creative, but I think it's way better to be prepared and be looking forward than to be ignoring it before the problem's too late.
And yet I haven't heard Obama or McCain say three words about the Farm Bill in 18 months of politicking.
You know, they probably talk about it when they're in the Midwest, making sure that the ethanol producers are happy.
Right.
And, you know, the big operators are going to continue to get their direct payments and, you know, all kinds of other supports.
So, Dan, the next Farm Bill will be up for debate or reform or, you know, however you want to look at it, what, in another 5 to 7 years?
Yeah, I would say 2012 is what most people are looking at right now.
So we've got time to get our sorts about us. And I know that you've discussed, some baby steps that people can take, intervention points that people can take to get informed, to get involved, to help sort of push for reform. Can we talk about those in preparation for this 2012 Farm Bill?
Yeah. The next Farm Bill debate starts today.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts on the momentum that millions of citizens who tuned into the last bill and were pretty upset that we didn't have more significant reform really, really worked for. And we put our legislators on the hot seat, and we have to continue to keep those seats extremely hot. And I would say reaching out to the medical community, reaching out to healthcare, nutritional community is something that wasn't done very well in the last Farm Bill. If we can make this connection between the diet that we're creating through cheap industrial food and the cost, the medical cost of treating nutritional diseases, and somehow see our food system as preventive health care. If we can, you know, feed our kids healthy foods in school, teach them about food production and about nutrition and you know, develop good lifelong habits. In the end, I think we're going to save money and we're going to be a healthier, more productive, happy people. You know, obviously, looking around and creating networks at the local level and trying to figure out what are the needs to increase the amount of local food production in your area. Is it some kind of refrigerated truck that could drive, you know, from farm to farm to farm, picking up food and closing some kind of a loop that needs to be closed in the local food system? Or is it, you know, some money that would go to local farmers who could grow food to feed senior citizens healthy foods or food banks or schools? You know, all these things, that they have to be figured out in terms of priorities, and then they have to be phrased in terms of policies that could be written into a law, and then they have to be sold to local legislators to champion them. And I think that was one thing that was not necessary. You know, by the time 2008 Farm Bill ultimately came about, many of the negotiations were already over. And so starting now and organizing now I think
so. You have a model to sell.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, the one thing that I want to bring up here is that a small amount of money for, you know, a solar powered drying facility or a mobile slaughtering unit or some new slaughtering facility for grass pastured livestock in your region, you know, these investments, they have huge payouts. Mm-hmm. So if you can just imagine, instead of $20 billion going out to the commodity groups that are already making record profits, and these aren't serving as safety nets, okay? If these things were safety nets, I can get behind them. But there should be no subsidization without some kind of social obligation or social benefit. But if we could see $20 billion in investments in community food systems all over the country, which even most scientists agree is where we have to go. We have to go from global fossil fuel-oriented production to regional, local, biologically based production. These kind of investments are really what the Farm Bill ought to be addressing.
So, Dan, let me ask you one last question then. Is there any indication, because you are so involved in the Food and Farm Bill, is there any indication of presidential interest? Have you heard from anyone directly?
Well, I've been involved indirectly.
Okay.
I would say there's a lot of interest. There's a lot of interest, at least from the folks that want to influence the campaigns.
Okay.
Maybe not necessarily that are being asked. And mm-hmm. you know, I've been driving across the country this last couple weeks, taking my son back east, and we stopped at Mount Rushmore, and they had the champion of agrarianism, Thomas Jefferson, and the champion of trust-busting, Theodore Roosevelt, enshrined there in Mount Rushmore. And I thought, you know, we should be so lucky as to have a president mm-hmm. who really understands those two American values.
Yeah. All right, Dan, thank you so much.
Thank
we really
you,
appreciate your time.
And good luck.
Thank you for your time.
Uh-huh. Dan Imhoff is the author of Food Fight, The Citizen's Guide to a Food and Farm Bill. He's also the author of Paper or Plastic and Farming with the Wild, published by Watershed Media. For more information on Dan Imhoff and Food Fight, please see our website at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and a new Latin word of the week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishing.
I remain Bob Hill.
And we've got a couple of questions to get through this week, Bob. First one, I think this one's up your alley. You're a pumpkin grower, aren't you?
Of sorts. Yeah.
This particular question is from Kevin, and he's wondering if it's too late to grow pumpkins this year. Of course, at the request of his daughter, she wants to grow some. What do you think?
Well, you can plant them, you just won't get any pumpkins.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah, it is too late. That's something you have to start much earlier in the year because it takes, what, 120 days or so to get a pumpkin. If you want big ones, actually, you want to also prune them back as you go.
Yeah.
And just have two or three, you know, nice ones you can play with and they'll get bigger for you. But, yeah, I'm afraid it is, Kevin.
Yeah, and usually once you get your seed packets always tell people how many days to maturity it takes for any you know, vegetable that you're growing. So always check the back of that. And you can kind of count back from the estimated last hard frost of the season, which is usually right around Halloween, I guess.
Yeah, we're sure to miss the state fair in this one.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, a little too late. All right, another question. This one's from Kathy Kleeman. Bob, she would love to have a fern in a container on either side of her front porch. The problem is they would get full afternoon sun. Are there any ferns that could tolerate the sun heat it would get during Louisville's hot summers there in the afternoon? If not, is there another plant that we can recommend that's similar in shape? Any ideas?
Yeah, I don't know of any ferns. I like, there's one called Mexican feather grass we grew this year. It's kind of an upright grass. And it's kind of ferny. It's more flowery, obviously, more grassy, but it's a mm-hmm. nice upright plant. Did
but
really well.
That would
well.
Give the same sort of effect as a fern.
Oh, yeah. And then the grass little bunny, mm-hmm. the fountain grass little bunny, looks kind of like those in containers. And there's also the purple fountain grass. It's an annual, mm-hmm. but it's an upright purple, and people like that a lot. It can get pretty big, actually.
Yeah, and I think people, they forget about some of these cool perennials when right. it comes to containers. So yeah. those grasses are, I think, a really good idea. Yeah. Another fern, which is not really a true fern, but the foxtail fern.
Yep.
That would handle the heat just fine. They like, basically, the only finicky thing about foxtail ferns, they like consistency. So once they get kind of situated to a room or to a place on the patio, they right. like to stay there. It's kind of funny. So that'll give you the Absolutely. Same effect. So, or cool ornamental grasses or perhaps a foxtail fern.
Absolutely. If you have a question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or just call us at 814-8246. Well, Miss Wishy, today's Latin word has something to do with climbing stairs, doesn't it?
Sort of, yes.
Sure does.
It absolutely does.
Yeah.
The Latin word of the week this week is ascendens.
I love that word.
It is a pretty...
It's fun to say that.
It's a nice sounding word. A-S-C-E-N-D-E-N-S.
It'd be ascendens. A great first name for a beautiful woman.
Ascendens.
Ascendens Jones.
Yeah.
I like it.
It's very pretty.
Yeah.
And of course, it suggests ascending, like the stair... as Bob alludes to.
Yep.
But ascendance means rising upwards in a sloping fashion.
That's me about 9 o'clock at night.
Yeah. and a sloping down. You're rising downwards
I'm
in a sloping,
sloping
fashion.
I know that.
You know, this word, do you know whose name pops into my, or whose face pops into my head? Tracy DeSabato Ost. Because when she talks about pruning perennials, she talks about the whole sort of, you can sculpt them in an ascending sort of way.
Oh, yeah.
That upward slope, staircase. Like bee balm. You know, cut it down low in the front and let yep. it go high in the back and the value of that. So I think of ascendens now with Tracy. But plants, aster ascendens.
The chili aster.
Chili aster.
Not cold, but the native yeah. land.
Chile.
Sorry.
There you go. Not the chili.
Doesn't come in a bowl.
Chile aster.
Rising upward.
Calamintha sylvatica subspecies ascendens.
The woodland calamint.
Calamint, which actually is a great plant.
Sounds like lotion.
It's very nice. Taxodium ascendens.
This is a plant I love, and I've only seen one or two mm-hmm. around here. The pond cypress. I get excited talking about it because it grows, the needles grow straight up.
Ascendens, too, in that
yeah.
sort of, if you look at the whole,
yeah.
the way that the needles are growing straight up and the way that they're going to grow on the actual branches.
Do you have some of those at your place?
We don't have pond cypress. We've got bald cypress.
I don't know why.
And if you go to the southeast and like down in New Orleans, when we were yeah. down in New Orleans several years ago, and you go in those little swampy areas and the little boats, and like
yeah.
the pond cypress are growing out of the water there.
Yeah.
And
I
it's
got
just
one
fabulous.
In my parking lot, and I'm going to get more.
Yeah.
I
fabulous.
Love it.
Batrachium ascendens.
This sounds like a medical disease again. The triangle lobe moonwort.
So, yeah, I'm not entirely sure what's ascendens about that, but obviously
well,
something
reaching
is.
Reaching to the moon. It's the moonwort.
Something is.
The triangle lobe moonwort.
Yeah. So, ascendens rising upwards in a sloping fashion. It makes perfect sense, really, don't
it
you think,
me.
Bob? Some things in this world don't. Some things
this
in this
does.
World do. Thank goodness. All right. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, giant ragweed and its sidekick, the earthworm.
Homegrown is produced by the vertically enhanced Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.